Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Matthews. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Earl Partington from Honolulu, Hawaii. I have represented the petitioner in this case, Christopher Matthews, from the beginning of this case, with one exception. I did not represent him in the debate hearing because I was a witness at that hearing. This case presents some very serious issues involving public policy, and in particular relating to the dignity and integrity of the judiciary, as well as the policy question of finality of judgments. I think the starting point for this case should be the wording of MRE 509. And I think it's important that we examine that wording because it is critical to the outcome of this case. It begins, except as provided in MRE 606. And I think this except clause is extremely important. The deliberation of courts and grand and petitaries are privileged to the extent that such matters are privileged in trial of criminal cases in the United States District Courts. Now the question is, what obviously does this mean? The government's position is that courts only means court members. It is petitioner's position that courts here quite clearly means state courts, federal courts, and military courts in the sense of judges.
Counsel, whether or not it means courts, assuming arguendo it does, didn't the judge voluntarily waive any privilege by testifying?
Well, I don't think this is a privilege that can be waived in the ordinary sense of privileges. If you look at the other privileges...
Is it an absolute privilege that simply exists by ipso facto because there is a judiciary or what?
Well, I've been wrestling with this issue on the flight over here from Honolulu because this is really more of a prohibition than a privilege. And I could not think of any situation where this privilege should or could be broken or waived.
Who does it belong to?
Well, that's the question. I think it would belong...
Who can assert it?
...to the trial judge if it belongs to anyone, that is the presiding judge. But I tend to think that this is really an absolute prohibition as a matter of public policy.
It belongs to the presiding judge, so it's up to... I don't know how many judges there are in the military, but... So every judge has their own little privilege and can apply it any which way they want? Is that a uniform code?
No, I didn't mean it in that sense, Your Honor. What I meant is that if a judge is called as a witness at any hearing or trial, if the privilege belongs to anyone, it would belong to the presiding judge. It certainly cannot belong to the parties. That would make no sense at all. And it certainly cannot belong to the testifying judge, because as Kimmelman noted...
How do you end up with a uniform policy and standard, then, if each presiding judge can decide, oh, well, I'm a judge who always talks about how I balanced, and I'm the judge who doesn't?
Well, I tend to think it's...
So your standard of justice depends on which judge you get.
I personally feel it's an absolute prohibition. That is, this is not something that can be waived.
Then why is it in the privilege section of the MREs, along with all the other privileges that can?
Well, I think because there is no better place to put it. If you look with all of the other privileges, with the exception of the vote secrecy privilege, they all explain who has the privilege and who can waive it. The vote secrecy privilege, obviously, it's self-evident who can waive that one. And yet this particular privilege, and as I say, I think it's a prohibition, does not contain any of that guidance. And as a result, it's my position, it's absolute. There is no situation I can think of where a judge would testify. Now, I know on this court...
So where's the language, and you might ask us this question, but that's not how it works. Where's the extraordinary situation language come from in McNutt?
I'm not sure. I think there would be abundance of caution.
And I might note, I mean, I can ask that, but okay, go ahead.
Well, it's often dangerous for a lawyer to say never. And I've debated whether I should say never, that it's absolute here, for fear that one of the learned judges in this court would come up immediately with a situation I hadn't thought of. But I can't think of a situation where this privilege should ever be broken. I think the policy of making sure that a judge's decision-making is sacrosanct.
Well, the Fifth Circuit and the Fairweather Court and a number of others have described some circumstances where...
Well, but I tried to...
And you don't buy into those?
I don't buy those. I just don't see where it's relevant, and I think it's dangerous. I mean, I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I've been one for nearly 40 years now, and I would love to be able to get a judge to question him. But it's demeaning to the judiciary. It brings the judge down from the pedestal that the judge needs to be on if he's to have the respect of the parties and the public. I can't just see in a situation where you can put a judge on the witness stand and grill him about his decision-making process. Even in the corruption examples, the decision-making process of a judge is not of particular value. The question is, was the judge corrupted? Even if the judge was going to rule the way he did in a corruption situation, the issue is whether or not he was induced to go in that direction or not. And I think that's very important.
Does your case depend on 509? Or are you relying as well or not at all on some concept of federal common law or an amorphous judicial concept or privilege?
I don't think it really matters.
You presented this as a 509 case.
Well, I did because the court presented the issue that
way. Do you lose if we disagree with you on 509?
Well, I think we still win because federal common law, you cannot call a judge. I mean, the intent of 509 is to have a rule that is consistent with the rules in the United States District Courts. And those rules very, very clearly say you cannot call a judge. And whether this privilege is absolute or not, I don't think is important for this case. The court need not reach it. Because I think under any, even if you have extraordinary exceptions, there was no extraordinary grounds in this particular case to penetrate the privilege. Certainly permitting Judge Dixon to testify as he did, I think undercuts the whole basis of what we want in judges. His testimony was more than 3 years after the trial. It's in a situation, do you really expect a judge is going to say, no, I made a mistake? I mean, we're human. Any judge is going to convince himself in the course of that three-year period that his decision was right. It doesn't mean the judge is not trying to be honest and truthful. It's just that, I think as noted in the opening brief in Rice, that you just can't expect that you're going to get accurate testimony where you've had such a long passage of time. And it's demeaning to have the judge cross-examined.
Let's say you're right and you prevail. What remedy should you receive?
Well, I think the matter needs to go back for a new sentencing, because there is no way that the harmless error standard can be applied in this case, because if you take away all of the judge's testimony, you are left with the judge's extrajudicial statement that he improperly considered, that he considered the fact that the defense witnesses took the Fifth, which is improper. This is going to be a classic McNutt example. And if you look at the evidence in this case, the trial judge himself found that Matthews did not have a loaded firearm in this assault because he acquitted him of that charge, and he convicted him by substitution of only having a weapon. Of particular importance was the forensic evidence by the...
You don't believe the CCA could determine, make a judgment as to whether the error was harmless or beyond a reasonable doubt or harmless in some manner? Do you think it has to go back for sentence rehearing?
Well, yes, I do. A retrial on this on the particular charge in question, the assault. I would assume that it could go back for resentencing on the cocaine charges, but I think on the aggravated assault charge, it will have to go back for retrial. Because if the defense witnesses were believed, and this was a close case, Matthews would be entitled to an acquittal on that charge, or at least on the aggravated assault charge. I will certainly concede that there was enough evidence to convict him of a simple assault. But I don't see how a sentence could be determined if the case went back to the Criminal Court of Appeals to affirm it. And I'm not sure they could affirm, in view of the state of the record, the aggravated assault. I think that would have to be retried.
Do you see a difference between a an informal blurting out, as we might say happened in McNutt, and formal testimony by the judge? Remember the facts in McNutt,
that was
an informal post-trial session in which the judge basically allowed his how, blah, 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 blah. And here you have testimony.
I think there's a big difference. Where the judge gratuitously makes an extrajudicial statement, that is a fact matter. Of course, judges can always testify as fact witnesses if the judge is...
Well, but it's more than that. He made an extrajudicial statement about what he thought about his thought processes. And that's not like question two in the debate hearing, which was simply, did he say it?
Well, that's correct. But yeah. I think it's the fact that when the judge says that, then that is a fact, as this court found in McNutt, that can be considered. But it's quite another matter to call the judge as a witness. The government said here that the judge testified willingly. We don't know that. The judge was ordered to come to Fort Knox to testify. This was no different than compelled testimony by a subpoena in a civilian court. Certainly, the question should have been raised by somebody at the debate here as to whether this was proper. And I'm very surprised. I didn't know this testimony occurred until afterward. I was really surprised.
Well, is it waived or forfeited since it wasn't raised at the debate hearing?
Well, no, I don't think so, because I would argue that the judge could be, testifying judge, doesn't hold the privilege. He can't waive it. And therefore, this...
Nobody objected.
Nobody objected.
Here he is, he's talking, and nobody's objecting. In that forfeiture?
Well, then we're walking into ineffective assistance of counsel territory.
Well, counsel, that in this case you did not raise ineffective assistance of counsel. So we have a situation in which, let's assume that we agree with you, at least in the end point, that the privilege here is one that doesn't have a waiver component to it. That is, that the person called to testify can't waive because that person is not the sole holder of the privilege. Then, if the information comes out at trial, and it's, in this case, a debate hearing, and it's used against the defense, and the defense counsel doesn't object, we're then in a different situation. We're not dealing with waiver of the privilege. We're dealing then with waiver and objection of an objection to otherwise inadmissible testimony. Why don't we have a waiver or a forfeiture in this situation?
Well, my answer to that would be that the public policy considerations are so strong that this court must say that you cannot tolerate this situation.
Well, counsel, the debate hearing was called to resolve a factual dispute as to what the military judge relied upon, correct? What he said?
Well, it was called to determine if he had made this extrajudicial statement.
And there was affidavit saying that he had, and there was affidavit saying that he had not, correct?
That's correct.
What else do you think people expected was going to happen at the debate hearing other than that the military judge was going to be called and testify? Why are you acting like that was a big surprise?
Because he should have been called to testify to determine whether or not he said the statement in issue. His deliberations were not involved at all. If you look at the certified questions by the Army Court, there was nothing in there to indicate that the court was looking for testimony concerning his deliberations. It was whether or not he made the statement in court after court had recessed. And that didn't require any testimony on deliberations.
Well, there was another question, though, and that had to do with 512.
Yes.
Didn't that get into his deliberations?
I don't think so. I don't think it was necessary, and I think that it was dangerous to go into a judge's deliberations for all the policy reasons set forth in Rice and Kimmelman.
Well, but you know, as to Judge Ryan's question, here's the question, 512. How can the defense be surprised by if the 512 question is sitting there, along with the did he say it question?
Well, I think the answer is Rule 509. That's the limitation imposed on what testimony can be obtained from the judge.
And I understand your position that in this context, given the sanctity of the judge's deliberations, we shouldn't apply waiver or forfeiture. if we disagreed with you, which would be in play here, waiver or forfeiture, in your view?
Well, I don't think it would be waiver. I think it would have to be a forfeiture issue, whether the question was forfeited.
And then would we review for plain error?
Yes. And I would submit that this would be plain error.
And then you'd be back to your basic argument in any event.
That's correct.
Counsel, you reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you'll have an opportunity at that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. My name is Captain Elizabeth Walker, and I, along with Colonel Denise Lind, represent the government in this matter. The Army Court of Criminal Appeals did not err in holding that MRE 509 does not apply to military judges.
What does the word court mean then?
Your Honor, the word courts means any type of court which involves military members. When we look to the history and the source of the language of MRE.
I've read your legislative history argument, and I find it unconvincing. Or rather, it proves too much. 509 speaks of courts, and it speaks of grand and petit juries. It obviously was taken over whole hog from federal rules. Not only was the court part never tinkered with, the petit jury part was never tinkered with. Unless you read it for the court part to be totally redundant, I don't see how that's a legitimate reading.
Your Honor, it's possible that the word courts could mean courts of inquiry or provost courts. Those are courts which in the military justice system, although they do involve essentially a members type situation. So it's possible that that's exactly what
the government meant. Would that be normal legislative drafting? To use an inclusive word that 99.9% of the time in the military context means courts-martial, and 0.0001% of the time means anything else, and leave it in there? Does that make sense from a legislative drafting standpoint?
Well, it does in this case, Your Honor, because when we look to the word courts-martial within the RCM 103, courts-martial is defined as members and military judges. But prior to 1968, when we didn't have military judges within the court-martial system, but we had this language of courts and grand and petit juries, we didn't have military judges.
What were the law officers at that time? What function did they perform in the military justice system?
They would have performed essentially as judges. Normally.
That's right.
Didn't we hold
it? Was it your view that law officers could be hauled before a court-martial and forced to give testimony as to their deliberations before 1968?
No, Your Honor, not under the federal case law. It would have been privileged.
So it was privileged then, and it was somehow the creation of the military judiciary that then subjected them to being called before courts-martial to testify as to deliberative process? Is that the purpose of the 1968 legislation?
No, Your Honor. That's not the government's position. Our position is that there is a privilege, but it doesn't exist within MRE 509. It applies to the courts-martial through the federal common law and is pulled in through MRE 501.
And who can assert it?
It would be the military judge, Your Honor.
And under what circumstances? And what's its reach?
Your Honor, the privilege is one that is held by the judge. It is a privilege that he or she determines whether or not it's appropriate to waive. It does appear from the federal cases that it is a sacred privilege, it's a strong privilege, but it's one that the military judge, in extraordinary circumstances, like the circumstances.
Where does extraordinary circumstance or situation come from?
It's cited in McNutt, Your Honor, but it's cited from the Stewart v. Southeast Foods case, which was a Mississippi case looking at the FRE 606 rule of evidence.
So it is derived from case law, which finds it in some manner in 606. Is it expressed in 606, or is it it's an inferred exception?
It's essentially inferred, Your Honor. What the McNutt case explained was, in looking to and interpreting 606B, the court looked to 605, where it interprets a judge as a witness in a particular case. And the court said that essentially because 605 is silent as to the exceptions that are laid out in 606B, it can be inferred at that time or at that point.
So that's the foundation. There's no further foundation. In the appellant's brief, or one of them, I can't remember which, it's says counsel could not find a single case, federal or state, that sanctioned the calling of a judge to testify as to his or her deliberative process. Did you find cases that demonstrated otherwise?
No, Your Honor. The federal cases don't have situations where it was sanctioned that a judge testified. However, those cases can be distinguished. In many of those cases...
Did you find any state court cases?
No, Your Honor.
So
no.
You would agree, you don't agree with what to infer from it, but you would agree with the appellant that there are no cases that expressly sanction a judge exploring his deliberative process?
Correct, Your Honor. However, those cases can be distinguished. Those cases can be distinguished because all of the policy reasons set forth in not having a military judge testify do not apply in this case.
Why not?
We have a military judge that... I'm sorry, Your Honor, did you have a question?
I said, why not?
Because in this case, we had a military judge who made a commentary after general findings voluntarily as to how he assessed the credibility of witnesses and how he weighed their testimony. That's where he waived the privilege. And having him testify at a duvet subsequent to that...
Assuming it's his privilege to waive, and assuming if it was his to waive, he was applying the correct law in doing so. You would agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why, you said none of the reasons in those other cases pertain to this case. Here's one reason, passage of time and accuracy of testimony. So you think you get the best testimony about what he was deliberating on 3 years later? How do you deal with that? You said none of them apply. That's one of them.
Correct. Well, because, Your Honor, he had already made these statements on the record. It was already a matter of record. And when we look to what he testified in the duvet, he essentially reiterated everything that he had already said on the record.
Well, if it was the same, why did you have to go get, what was the point?
Your Honor,
why not just stick with the record then?
The purpose of having him testify was specifically in regards to the ACCA's order for the duvet, which was the comment or that he made during the recess that was alleged by appellant. And how, whether or not he did draw an adverse inference from the invocation and whether he made the statement.
What did he say about making the comment during the recess?
Your Honor, when he testified, he denied making the statement.
What more needed to be asked at that point? If he denied making the statement, what would be the purpose of getting the views of his deliberative process about a statement that he denied making?
Because the other part of the order from the duvet, Your Honor, was whether or not he drew an adverse inference. And so that's where we get back to the comments he made on the record, because that gives us...
Isn't he required to make those comments on the record? And if he didn't draw an adverse inference on the record, what more needs to be said? Doesn't our court and doesn't the Court of Criminal Appeals all the time look at the record for a judge's deliberative process and not look beyond that? And there are situations in which the judge makes a statement and gives forth that judge's reasons, certain deference is given. When the judge doesn't give reasons, less deference is given. And that happens all the time. Do we ever have a situation in which we say, well, that judge didn't give his or her reasons, we're going to call that judge before a debate hearing to get the explanation?
Well, the extraordinary circumstance in this case required it, Your Honor, because he had made these statements on the record, but it was alleged that he made an extrajudicial statement. So it was important to go into
why? Isn't the question simply, did he make the statement or didn't he, which is a question of fact?
It is, Your Honor, but...
Then why do you have to poke into his deliberative processes to determine whether he made a question, an off-the-record statement of fact? He either did or he didn't.
In order to assess whether or not he drew a negative inference, that's the importance of having him discuss those matters that he put...
So is the import of the debate hearing that he lied about whether he made the statement or not, but the debate judge nonetheless was going to rely on what he said about his deliberative process? We're going to take a judge who doesn't have any credibility as to the truth of his assertion as to whether he made an extrajudicial statement, and we're not going to, the duvet judge says, we're not going to believe you on that, but we will believe you on what you say about your deliberative process. What sense does that make?
Well, what he said, Your Honor, what he testified to is that he did not recall making such a statement. That was his testimony. And then he went further to say, that is not normally something I would have said. I would not have made a comment like that because I didn't draw an adverse inference. So I don't think it was necessarily a commentary by the DuBay judge that the military judge lied. It was more he, in essence, he didn't recall. And he said, in my normal practice, I wouldn't have drawn a negative inference, and I didn't in this case. And therefore, you know, it's not really an issue of whether or not he lied. He just didn't recall. And so therefore, the DuBay judge found that he made the statement based on the testimony of defense counsel.
So the DuBay judge then said, we're going to believe you that you don't recall, and we're also going to determine what you do or do not recall anyway, even though you don't recall anything about this.
Yes, Your Honor. This is a seasoned judge. He had quite a bit of experience. He testified to that during the DuBay. It's not unreasonable for the DuBay judge to rely on the things that he did recall and the things that he did testify about. And it's not inconsistent to then find, well, he didn't really recall that he made the statement, but we can still rely on all the other testimony that he gave, because he had been a judge for approximately 4 years at that time that he testified.
Let me make sure I understand the distinctions as to which law the appellant would apply 509 and, in the alternative or in addition, federal common law. If there's a difference of view here, I think it's your view that, yes, we would apply federal common law, but not 509. And then the legal difference of view is, under federal common law, whether this is a circumstance where that warrants, that is extraordinary in some manner, that warrants further inquiry. Is that a fair summary of how you, of at least the difference of view on what law pertains?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is that it would be federal common law that applies.
And you would not, is it your view that in general, putting aside where this extraordinary exception thing is derived from, it would be your view that the general principle would be such deliberative matters are not to be delved into?
The general rule would be correct.
So you don't contest that federal common law disfavors and such inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The debate is over whether this is a case that warrants inquiry nonetheless.
Yes. The debate here is that this was an extraordinary circumstance and that the deliberative process...
I just want to make sure I'm framing this correctly. If a waiver of forfeiture pertains to this case, which is it?
It would be forfeiture, Your Honor.
In which case we would review for plain error, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And then we're back to the... Is it plain and obvious violation of federal common law or 509 or whatever?
Correct, Your Honor.
Would you address the defense point with respect to the waiver of the privilege position regarding the existence of waiver considerations in the other rules of privilege and contrast that to 509? That is, looking at the structure of the rules, where would you derive the right of a judge to waive the privilege from the structure of the rules?
Well, when we look to the other rules of privilege that are codified within Section 5 of the MREs, Your Honor, what we're protecting is a particular relationship of privilege. For example, we're looking at the psychotherapist-patient privilege. We're looking at the attorney-client privilege, communications to clergy. And so for the waiver of privilege in those rules, it can either be the individual who holds the privilege that can waive it, or the person to whom they communicated. Those are different than what we have in a situation with the military judge alone, because there is no relationship. It's the holder of the privilege alone during his deliberations. Typically, a military judge isn't going to communicate with anyone while he or she deliberates, and so therefore, they are the sole holder of the privilege and the sole individual who can waive that privilege.
Why doesn't that support the defense view that it's a systemic prohibition rather than a privilege of a privilege related to a particular communication? That is, the defense position is actually in sync with what you were saying there, and that is, this particular privilege doesn't involve a communication between two people. It involves a process, and that the process is what the defense views as sacrosanct here, and therefore there is nothing to waive.
Well, Your Honor, what's important in any judicial privilege situation is that judges are cautioned not to waive the privilege because it is
How do you caution a judge to not waive the privilege when you haul him before a debate hearing?
Well, Your Honor, he had already waived the privilege at trial when he made the comments. So at that point, the cat was already out of the bag, essentially.
Well, then I go back to what the chief judge said. Why do you haul him before a debate hearing if it's a cat's out of the bag?
Well, to clarify the issue of the MRE 512 issue about whether or not he made the comments.
That's a legal issue that I would presume a CCA can deal with. Why do you need a factual inquiry into his deliberative processes to see if he relied on Rule A or Rule B? Isn't that the kind of thing CCAs do all the time?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, it's important to determine whether or not the comment was made and did it have an impact on.
Well, that's question two. Did he say it? That's a question of fact that doesn't involve delving into his processes.
Correct, Your Honor. But then the Army Corps also had to assess what impact, if any, did it have on his deliberative process.
Well, how could the comment he made afterwards have any impact on his deliberative process?
Are you saying you mean the comment after the recess, yeah. Your Honor? Well, it would have had an impact. The reason that was a question for the court was because he had already assessed all the credibility on the record, and he essentially had said that he believed witnesses had conspired their testimony, and he didn't believe the defense witnesses. So any comment that he made after the fact during the recess that he really didn't believe one particular witness because that person revoked would have been inconsistent with what he had already put on the record about his deliberative process.
Once that was said or not said, though, why isn't that sufficient for the Dubay judge and the CCA to decide how to proceed? Either he made the comment and you've got the problem, or he didn't make the comment and you don't have the problem.
Your Honor, it wouldn't give the court enough information or enough insight to simply determine whether or not the comment was made, to determine whether it had an impact, because again, it would have seemed to have been inconsistent with what the military judge had already been put on the record.
Isn't that a problem we've got that's inherent in appellate jurisprudence on a record? I mean, sure, it's always easier for an appellate court to say, oh, go back and poke around in his brain and we'll get some useful stuff. But that's not the point, is it? We do this all the time. Is this on the record? What did he say on the record? What happened on the record? We don't kick it back for a Dubay every time we wish we had more stuff. So why here?
Your Honor, this was that extraordinary circumstance. This was the extraordinary situation.
What? What's extraordinary about this that doesn't appear in 50 cases a year?
You generally don't see, Your Honor, a military judge put on the record his deliberative process voluntarily, sua sponte, and that's essentially what we had in this case. He assessed the credibility and weight of evidence on the record for all parties to hear. And when he did so, that created this extraordinary circumstance, and he even testified to it at the Dubay. If you look at the joint appendix on page 67, he said, this was an unusual circumstance for me. I normally don't put, essentially, my thought process in my deliberation.
And boy, I won't do it again, will I?
Well, what if we have a 403 situation? Isn't it quite typical, in fact, it's expected by this court, that the judge will put the deliberative process on the record if the judge wishes to get some deference from the appellate court?
Well, Your Honor,
and doesn't that involve a very detailed assessment of witnesses and credibility and proof?
And you're referring to MRE 403, correct,
right,
Your Honor, in assessing 403.
Right.
Normally, the 403 balancing test, correct, Your Honor, the judge will usually make a conclusory statement whether or not evidence is more prejudicial than it is probative. Usually, we do not see judges, though, delve into exactly how they weighed the evidence and how they assessed that balance.
Well, our case law says that conclusory statement, there are three levels of deference there. No statement gets no deference. Conclusory statement gets little deference. Detailed analysis gets great deference. We do see in the record judges who give detailed analyses, whether it's because they want to get deference from our court or whether they think that's the right thing to do, I don't know. But in those cases, in a case where the judge doesn't give that kind of detailed statement, are we then going to be in a situation where, based on the ruling that the government asked for in this case, a Dubay hearing can probe the innermost thoughts of the judge? If the judge says,
Yeah, I'd be willing to go before a debate hearing and talk about that. I'd be glad to tell you what I was thinking.
No, Your Honor. When a judge makes a conclusory statement in situations where that occurs at that level, there's no waiver of privilege. In the situations opposite that, where a judge gives a detailed balancing for the record, there's still not a blanket waiver typically, and it's going to be a factual situation depending on...
How about if the judge sees that the case is on appeal, it's a case in which he or she made a conclusory statement or no statement, and writes a letter to the parties and says, here's what I was thinking. Is that a waiver of the privilege? Now the judge has blurted everything out.
No, Your Honor. In the situations that's when we refer to all the policy reasons set out in the federal common law for a judge coming after the fact and making commentary or considering evidence after the fact. Then we apply all those policy reasons. This situation is different and extraordinary because the judge made the deliberative process waiver on the record, not after the fact, after having time to think about it or reflection or being called years later to testify about it.
Okay, if we were correct in McNutt and that 606B doesn't apply except to members, but 509 applies to everybody, then doesn't 509 establish exactly the kind of privilege that the appellant is claiming it does? Because 509 says except as provided in 606. If 606 doesn't apply, there isn't anything. It's all locked up, right?
No, Your Honor. And I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
You'll have all the time you need to answer Judge Stuckey's question.
The answer to that would be no, Your Honor, because when we look to the rest of the text of the rule, it says that the privileges are limited to the extent as outlined in the district court cases. And when we look
Do you have any district court cases in which a United States district judge was made to testify about his deliberative processes?
There are situations where there was testimony, yes, Your Honor, but the appellate courts did not consider it and determined it was inadmissible. And again, those cases...
Okay, well, then doesn't that lead to the conclusion that the state of law in the district courts is as to judges testifying?
No, Your Honor, because those were situations where there was never any waiver on the record, and we have habeas, there are cases
well,
where...
Well, no, waiver on the record. If 606 doesn't apply, then there's no out. It's an absolute privilege that's inherent in the judiciary, one would seem. I'm not, leave the common law aside. I'm talking about 509. Mm-hmm. Assuming arguendo 509 applies to judges, you have one exception that we have held applies only to members. If 509 applies to judges, doesn't it follow that whatever privilege 509 establishes is absolute?
No, Your Honor, because that's not the government's position is that it would not be a necessarily appropriate interpretation of what the district court cases say.
Well, what do the district court cases say?
The district court situation cases are cases where there's a habeas corpus situation where an appellant is attacking their conviction several years after the fact. And in doing so, for example, in Washington v. Strickland, we have an individual who pled guilty and then went judge alone as far as his sentencing was concerned. And there was an issue about ineffective assistance of counsel at the sentencing level. So to attack that ineffective assistance and determining whether or not there was prejudice, they wanted to call the military judge, the trial judge, to testify about his deliberative process of sentencing. And that's where the Washington court set out all those policy reasons why, in circumstances like that, we shouldn't be calling judges to testify, which is a judge who never waived the privilege, who's being essentially interrogated and questioned about their decision-making process years after the fact in a federal court system.
Well, and here he's being interrogated about his deliberative process years after the fact in a debate. But how do you answer the appellant's contention that it's not waivable?
The government's position, Your Honor, is that, like any other privilege, it is waivable. Like any other privilege. It is a waivable privilege.
Thank you.
You may briefly summarize.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Army Court of Criminal Appeals did not err in holding that MRE 509 does not apply to military judges, nor did the rule bar the government from calling the military judge to testify about his deliberative process under the facts of this case. Therefore, this court should affirm the decision by the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Carlos, a few weeks ago, broke a bone in my foot. I just like to make a couple points. With regard to the situation of getting the information from the judge, in civilian practice, you ask the appellate court to remand the case to the trial court for additional findings. And if there is any appropriate way of getting additional findings, that would be it. It's not done by calling the judge as a witness. That opens Pandora's box. I would note that the federal habeas evidentiary hearing is the approximate equivalent of a debate hearing to the military. And in federal practice, you're not going to call a judge at a habeas evidentiary hearing. It's just not done. The government concedes that it's not done, and Kimmelman sets forth the reason why. And I think the point in Kimmelman is very important. It doesn't matter if the judge wants to testify. It cannot be tolerated for the policy reasons set forth in that case and in Rice, the Air Force Court of Military Review case. I think ultimately you have to look at just the plain wording of the rule. What does courts mean in Rule 509? And clearly it means any judge of any court. And that can include an administrative law judge. It includes anyone who has a judicial function. You're not going to permit that judge to be called to give his deliberative process reasons. Now, the word courts, the government suggests, could apply to courts of inquiry. Well, I doubt it very much. The rules of evidence do not apply to courts of inquiry. Obviously, this is meant to apply in courts-martial and, of course, debate hearings, which are subject to the rules of evidence. This is really, in a sense, a simple question. The court doesn't have to decide if there are any exceptions to this prohibition. I doubt that there are, but out of abundance of caution, the extraordinary circumstances rule can be left there. There's nothing extraordinary about this. Judges all the time make findings on the record and explain why they made the findings. That is the proper way for judges to do it. And as noted in I think it was in Kimmelman again, we look to that record. That's where we find what the judge intended.
Counsel, on that point, you say in your reply brief that without the trial military judge's testimony at the debate hearing, there would be no real way to determine how the military judge made his rulings as to the contested charge, right?
That's correct.
Why can't we look to the what he said on the record at trial?
Well, you can, but he also said on the record that he didn't believe these witnesses because they took the Fifth. The law presumes that the judge thus considered that in his findings. And if he did consider that was improper. He should not have, and therefore reversal is mandated.
What would the prejudice be, though? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to understand is, fine, let's say that one of the things he took into account was that this person had invoked the Fifth Amendment. That's not a violation of your client's constitutional rights.
Oh, yes, it is. It's a violation of his due process right to a fair and impartial judge. If the judge is considering matters that he may not consider, and obviously it's a very important, the privilege against self-incrimination is enormously important, and our law makes it clear that the invocation of a privilege may not be considered. And thus, if the judge considered it, my client had his due process right to a fair tribunal, to a fair judge, violated.
Counsel, you're arguing that every consideration of inadmissible evidence constitutes a constitutional violation, due process violation?
No, I think
so. What makes this a constitutional issue? Are we talking here about the defendant's self-incrimination rights?
Well, no, we're talking about the witness's
right.
rights.
So if we're talking about a witness's self-incrimination rights, why does the accused have a constitutional interest in whether or not the self-incrimination rights of a third party are protected?
Well, in this particular case, the testimony of these witnesses were critical. A government witness claimed they heard a gun being fired.
Well, understand, I don't think the chief judge is asking you whether he has an interest in the evidence. I think he's asking what's his constitutional interest. Similarly, if someone else's Fourth Amendment rights are violated and getting evidence is admitted at trial, it's not a constitutional violation of your client's Fourth Amendment right.
No, but it's a violation of my client's due process right to a fair tribunal. And in order to determine whether
That goes back to the chief judge's first question, which is, are you saying that every consideration of inadmissible evidence is a constitutional violation?
No, you have to look at the evidence to do a harmless error analysis.
But you don't do a harmless error. The test that you use for testing the error depends on whether it's a constitutional error or not. How are you getting to it being a constitutional error?
Well, any criminal defendant has the right to an impartial judge. That's a due process right that's recognized. And in order to determine if the defendant's due process rights are violated, you have to do the harmless error analysis. Was this evidence critical or not? And, of course, in this case, it was critical. So my answer to your question is that's how you arrive at that. This is a constitutional right that in order to determine if it's been violated.
But you're starting with the premise that every consideration of inadmissible evidence constitutes a due process violation.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. What I'm saying is to determine if there is a due process violation here, you have to examine the evidence and determine is this a close case or was this evidence basically cumulative or irrelevant. You have to make that analysis to determine if there is a due process violation. And I'm saying in this case, if you do that analysis by looking at the evidence.
Well, I think I might be in disagreement with you because I think that the analysis that you're talking about goes to whether there was prejudice or whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, depending on the test that you adopt. I don't think that the test you're talking about determines whether it was constitutional error or just error in the first instance.
Well, I think in examining any constitutional right, if you look at Supreme Court opinions, the denial of the right to trial by jury, where you're looking at various violations under the Bill of Rights, the United States Supreme Court will sometimes do a harmless error analysis and say, yes, the constitutional right was violated here, but there's no error. And our argument here is the due process right was violated here because he did not have a fair and impartial judge, but that may be harmless error. And that's why the facts are so critical. This was a close case. I think my time has run out.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you. I think that this court must send this case back to the Army Court of Criminal Appeals to determine whether or not this case should go back to a new trial on the assault charge, or whether this matter can be resolved perhaps by the committee authority either approving no punishment or ordering a new sentencing hearing on the cocaine charges alone. These are the alternatives. These are for the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, not for this court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case, you may be seated. The case is now submitted. And the court will stand in recess until 10:25 a.m.